We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Feel like Kobe in the fourth quarter. This is the Dame Moore NBA podcast brought to you by the Genesis Company, coming at you Thursday evening. We're live here at Falling Knife Brewing Company. Yeah. There we go. It's June 1st. We have game one of the NBA Finals here in about an hour. I thank you all for coming out. Looking forward to watching the game with you. Let's talk a little bit of finals here. Britt, maybe we'll start with that, and then we got another mic here set up. You could ask whatever you want. Any sort of Wolves question. I'm assuming it'll be Wolves questions, but we can talk finals or whatever is on your mind. So if you're listening at home, probably a little bit more Wolves specific stuff. 20 minutes, 15 minutes into this or something, I'd assume. But yes, again, if you have questions, come up here. You can line up whatever. Once we get there, I'm joined by Britt Robson from MinPost. Britt, let's just start by talking about this game. Jimmy Butler, Nikola Jokic, these NBA Finals. I was thinking about it this morning. I personally kind of struggled to find a way in my head to find how this series is going to be competitive. I think you maybe have a different opinion on this. I know that doesn't necessarily make sense, given that probably the two best teams coming into the playoffs were the Bucks and the Celtics, and Miami beat both of them. But I still look at this matchup, and I really think it's certainly Denver's to lose. And, struggle to see a way that Miami's going to win a lot of these. Where are you at just generally coming into game one of the finals?
Well, I think Miami's used to being underrated. They've been in the Eastern Conference Finals three of the last 4 years. They've been in the NBA Finals two of the last 4 years. So when it comes to lengthy playoff experience, their core is more experienced. They've gone further. This is the furthest Denver's gone by two rounds. No, I think they made the conference finals 1 year. But it's
semis, I think. I don't think they went to the conference finals.
But in terms of pedigree, in terms of playoff pedigree, I mean, since Butler arrived and Bam has been there and Spo has been the coach, they've gotten far. They lost in the first round is the only year that they didn't make at least the conference finals. This year, as an eighth seed that had to make it through the play-in and almost didn't, they had to go through the toughest schedule possible in many respects. The highest seed was, the Bucks, and they beat them. The Knicks were the highest seed that they could then face, and they beat them. And then the highest seed they could face after that was the Celtics, and they beat them. And I think that the odds of those franchises not playing well all in a row is not nearly as likely as the Bucks making them play worse. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that people don't realize about the Bucks. The Heat are extremely disciplined. They have a culture. They have accountability. They share the ball. They do not care about where a player has come from, whether they're the number one overall pick or whether they're undrafted. A lot's been made about the undrafted guys, but
They don't care what we think about them.
Whatever happens, they slot them in, they develop them, they slot them in, and it works. Butler was a missing piece of sorts, but you got to understand that Butler got himself kicked off three teams being an asshole, specifically to come to a place like the Heat that matched his, you know, level of intensity, accountability. He could not exist. It was pretty obvious to anybody who was covering him for the Wolves that it was a bad fit, that without Tibbs, it would have burned down even faster than it did. He essentially cost Tibbs his job, cost Fred Hoiberg his job. And, you know, in Philly, showed himself the door. So he's in the right place at the right time, match made in purgatory. And, you know, I think it's going to be kind of the idea of the Miami Heat being underdogs is not new to them, and it's the way they like it. And I think it'll be a competitive series. Whether it is the Denver in five, I think three or four of those five games will be decided in the last quarter or so. Series are, you know, you can win in six and two of the games can be slip ups and then you blow out the team in you know, four. So I expect a competitive series, whether or not it shows it on the scoreboard. I do think that Denver, on the other hand, should be the favorite, are the favorite. They've outperformed against every team that they play. There were a lot of smart people who picked Phoenix and then picked the Lakers. And I had Denver winning all three of those series that they won, but even having those picks, they were better than I thought they were going to be in every one of those series.
So I think in this matchup, if you're Miami and you're thinking about pulling an upset or even winning a like the game tonight, right, it is going to, as it does, so much hinges on the way in which you are able to guard or not guard Nikola Jokic. I know you're a big Bam Adebayo fan, and I would assume that's the primary matchup there. But historically, just guarding him with one player or even in just one-on-one hasn't been enough. How specifically do you think, and then I'll answer it too, but how do you think Miami is going to not shut the water off there, but be able to slow down what Denver does best in playing through Nikola Jokic?
I think it'll be very hard. Other teams have tried it. He is the most complete player in the NBA, in my opinion, certainly on offense. Certainly more indefensible than Steph Curry.
Yeah.
If you double him, he'll give you a dozen assists. If you let him go, he'll get 43. And he has a two-man game with Murray. Murray not being healthy the previous two playoffs made a huge difference. You can see they were great in the bubble together 3 years ago, and they're great now. Their two-man game is going to be Miami's biggest challenge. But in direct answer to your question, you have to go with Bam to some extent. He's your best big and you're one of your best defenders. But also, I mean, when Jokic is out on the high post, I think there are ways to do switches and do different kinds of – Miami plays a zone, more zone than anybody in the NBA. I'm not sure how the zone works against Jokic, quite frankly, because zone means you're not guarding a man and Jokic will pick you apart, theoretically.
I was looking that up this morning, and Denver was the second-best team in the NBA against zones during the regular season, and Miami ran so much zone themselves. I looked up and said it was 21% of their defense possessions was zone defense. And like to contextualize that, like the Wolves were average in terms of the frequency which they ran zone, and it was 2.8% of their possessions.
10 times as much.
Yeah, close to 10 times as much. I think, and I'm picking Denver, and I am tempted to even pick a sweep in this, but I think I'm not saying that's the most likely outcome, but I think that in Miami, if we're trying to find paths for Miami to be able to win this, I think part of it goes through the idea that they are probably the best zone defensive team in the league, or one of, they rely on it more than anybody else. And I think there's value in any sport when you're doing something so consistently, so much more frequently than any other team, that you have a comfort with this. I think a lot of people look at this series and go, Jokic is the best passer in the league, and it's a zone. He's going to pick apart a zone. But I think that's the difference. And if Miami does what they did against Milwaukee or against Boston and wins game one, it's because that zone ends up being significantly more problematic than anticipated. And I think the reason behind that will not be that they have like some incredible defensive personnel or defensive zone personnel. It's that they're so used to doing it. And I think particularly in the NBA, teams do it so rarely that, like, of course Nikola Jokic picks it apart, right?
Right.
And that, as I think about this series, because I don't think Bam's going to be able to take him one-on-one. I don't think you can put Kevin Love on him or Haywood Highsmith or something like that and have Bam lurk. Like, you have to have a kind of mainstay thing that ends up, you know, being effective in that sort of way. And I think the value for Miami is that they're so comfortable doing this that it could prove to be effective even against one of the best passers in the league.
One of the things about NBA basketball in 2023 is turnovers in transition are absolutely vital, so much more than ever before. And Miami is a great anticipatory team that can stay in scheme,
yeah,
jut out to try to create turnovers and then revert to their scheme again. Where I see Miami, if you want a formula for Miami success, it's turning Denver over. It's forcing misses from people that aren't Jokic. And it's getting out and getting out in transition, swinging the ball around, doing their what they've done for the last three series, which is really move the ball well and have people shooting without a conscience because they don't have any pressure. Miami's one of the few teams where if they are not one of the two or three stars, you don't have to feel like if I don't make this shot, my next missed shot after that is going to be it for me tonight.
Right.
And that is a tremendous amount of pressure, especially in the playoffs, to put on people. And I don't think it's a coincidence that Miami shoots well across the board when they're playing up-tempo, when they're playing their game and in living in their culture, because it is swing, swing. It's as close to San Antonio's old way, pass up a good shot for a great shot. And you got guys like Gabe Vincent and Caleb Martin who have really embraced that. Tyler Hero may be back later on, Duncan Robinson. You've got people, you've got depth of people who aren't afraid to shoot when they're open, and not being afraid in big money situations will increase your shooting percentage, probably 5 or 10%.
I mean, that's how they got out of the Boston series, right? Because Jimmy, in terms of his effectiveness, really fell off a cliff in the end of the Eastern Conference Finals. Why do you think that was, and why do you or not think that that will sustain here in the Denver series? Will he go back to, you know, playoff Jimmy, or did something change that Boston did that Denver can do as well?
I thought that Jimmy kind of knew he didn't have it, at least in two of those games. He wasn't his usual attacking self.
I thought Tatum on him made a big difference.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I also think that if you just change Caleb Martin into Jimmy Butler's position and vice versa, nothing really changed, at least in the last two games. Martin didn't have great games across the board. But my point is there really is a next man up thing. Butler was incredibly instrumental, probably the reason they beat the Bucks. Kind of instrumental against the Knicks, but not overly so. They, you know, didn't have him for a game, and he was more hobbled in that. And then in the Celtics series, he shouldn't have been MVP. I mean, you know, he was one of their three best players. But and the same thing with Bam. I just think that it's hard to game plan for the Bucks. I mean, I'll say it probably at least three more times before I'm done because it seems to be my mistake for the evening. But the Heat, it's hard to game plan for them because they don't have a guy. If you cut that guy off, you've made a huge difference in their game.
Well, and that's where I think Aaron Gordon comes in and is so important in this series. And I would assume that he's the one who draws the Jimmy matchup. And again, when we talk about the Tatum element, I thought the size of Tatum was such a factor for Jimmy in his game, of which is like in a lot of ways a lot more like old Manny, you know, like
right.
get people on the wrong foot, like the pump fake game, all those sort of things. And I think Tatum and his size and just guarding him with length, or the Boston guarding him with length in general, made a huge difference. And I think, I know we've talked about this a lot, like with Gordon, that's kind of what he's done throughout the playoffs, regardless of the matchup, whether it was LeBron, KD, or in the Wolves series, Cat. And I think Gordon knows that is his job in this series, or I would assume. And I'm really curious. I think like what we see tonight in terms of what Butler can do against Gordon opens up or closes doors in terms of what Miami can do in this series in general.
Yeah, I know the consensus is, and probably the truth of the matter is, that Gordon will start the series on Butler. I think Gordon is on Bam is a better matchup, and having Jokic be the floater, simply because Bam's aggression, Bam's screening, everything Bam does is lower key important to the team. And if you can blow that up, if you can blow Bam up, and Jimmy gets a lot of points,
sure.
Denver does have a luxury. One of the reasons that I would very reluctantly pick Denver to win this is because Aaron Gordon can guard either Bam or Jimmy or both at different times mm-hmm. during the series and during a game. That's tremendous flexibility to have a guy who can guard a legitimate two and a legitimate four or five.
Right.
Is great. But I think that Bam can hurt Denver if Gordon is not on him.
True.
And I think that's one of the ways that they can surprise you. I think that if Denver will obviously be coming in seeking to shut off the three. And I think Bam will be left open. I mean, if Jokic is on Bam, either Bam will get some points or Jokic will get in foul trouble.
Well, those of you who are here, if you do want to ask a question, we got a microphone over here. I'm going to get a prediction from you, Britt, on this series, but I'm assuming many of you probably don't even want to listen to us talk about the NBA Finals and would rather have us talk about Wolves stuff, but we'll leave it open to you guys. But Britt, just before this game starts in like a half hour,
yep.
What is your general read on this series of how it ends? If you want to pick Team X and Y games, what is
it? Well, I mean, I think I'm going to wind up saying Denver in five or six, and then I'm going to look at the series and just kick myself when Miami wins it in seven. You know, I mean, there is a part of me that says, you idiot. I mean, you really are going to underrate Miami again. You know, they beat the Bucks. They beat the Celtics. They have a phenomenal amount of confidence in themselves. They don't care whether they're at home or on the road. They don't care who's hurt and who isn't. They have the best coach by a country mile in the NBA. They have a lot going for them. And if I were a betting man, the odds, the money you could make on a Denver win would be what I would be betting now.
Betting down against?
I would be betting Miami because the odds are so great. It's like they're a compelling long shot, I guess is what I'm saying. But all that said, Denver seems almost unbeatable at home. They also are playing an extremely high level. I love the way they play. I love the way both of these teams play. I mean, I'm really looking forward. There's no evil team in this particular series for me. You know, I mean, there's no team that I really dislike. And there's no team that I feel like doesn't deserve their shot, or I would be unhappy to see them win a ring or whatever. Mm-hmm. But Denver, it feels like Denver's year. We've talked about this back and forth. I'll say Denver in six. I'll reserve the right to say I knew I'd be wrong.
I like if I was Stephen A. Smith, who was just up on that screen there a second ago and looking to make noise, like I think I would say Denver in a sweep. I found myself again this morning trying to find reasons to pick Miami from a basketball standpoint to even, you know, win one, two, three games. And I really got stuck on that. I think the answer for Miami is not even, it isn't X's and O's. It isn't a matchup. It isn't an adjustment. It's who they are.
Right.
And that is why they would win that series. I just think the likelihood of that to me seems so low that I'll go with Denver in five, which seems like the conservative middle there. But we'll take a quick break here and we'll come back and we'll take questions from any of you guys. Tom, I see you're ready over there. We can, it can be finals, it can be Wolves, it can be whatever. Quick break, we'll be back and we'll take some questions. Today's show is brought to you by the Genesis Company. As an entrepreneur, do you envision your innovative products on retail shelves? If that is you, then listen up. The Genesis Company is your guide to retail triumph. Their expert team has aided over 300 brands generate more than $3 billion in retail sales and is dedicated to transforming your dreams into reality. The Genesis Company amplifies your brand's potential by leveraging advanced marketing strategies and the latest technology. They specialize in extending direct-to-customer brands into mass retail and enhancing retail brands, DTC, or Amazon presence. But they offer more than just marketing. From retail consulting, packaging, and sales strategies, to operations, financing, and supply chain management, they provide a comprehensive end-to-end solution. And here's the best part. The Genesis Company is invested in your success. They're not just a service provider. They're your partner in growth. When your brand wins, they win too. If you're ready for the next level, contact them today at grow@thegenesiscompany.com. Let's scale your brand together. Today's show is brought to you by Hyacinth Restaurant in St. Paul. I've been telling you all season about Hyacinth, with their amazing food and warm, inviting atmosphere. And with the sun starting to come out, this is the perfect time to check out Hyacinth. Hyacinth does partner with local farms, and their chefs visit the Metro Farmers Markets four times a week as these markets open back up. So you know that no matter when you are eating at Hyacinth, you are having the freshest and most vibrant food Minnesota has to offer. St. Paul does have the reputation for being the sleepier of the two Twin Cities. And just like the Wolves are trying to change the narrative around their organization, Hyacinth wants your help to change the narrative about St. Paul. Hyacinth is also offering a $10 gift card for every reservation made after 8 p.m. So to receive your gift card, make a reservation on their website at hyacinthstpaul.com and you will receive the gift card on arrival. Limit one gift card per party and you must follow through with your reservation. So no show, no gift card. And then finally, Hyacinth is happy to announce the return of their sidewalk patio beginning Tuesday, May 16th. What started as a pandemic pivot has become a tradition at the restaurant. Reservations specifically for outdoor dining can also be made at their website, which is again, hyacinthstpaul.com. That's three more reasons to try out Hyacinth in St. Paul, a restaurant that has become a favorite of mine in the Twin Cities. That was so clap-worthy. All right, we are, we're back. Let's answer some questions. Anything you guys want to have answered, Wolves related or otherwise, what do you got, Tom?
Well, I think like one thing I've noticed that's kind of crazy about both these teams through these playoffs is roster depth. So like you look at like typically, you know, you get this far into the playoffs, you have that kind of 7, 8, 9 man rotation. But like Denver is like 5.5 and Heat is like 12, like as far as like available players that are kind of playing, like,
okay.
It's kind of crazy, right? Like, so what are the pluses and minuses of having, you know, Denver, you know, bringing in a 6-man rotation versus like the Heat with a 12-man, you know, possible rotation?
Well, probably depends who's healthy for Miami. Britt, you mentioned Tyler Hero coming back. I mean, I would say Denver's for sure got 6. I mean, Bruce Brown, Jeff Green's been good. I would think Christian Brown will also be involved in this series. I think Denver hasn't had to go deeper than 8 in the playoffs. They didn't have to against the Wolves. That was effective. I mean, Denver's just kind of been effective throughout the playoffs with eight. They cut Brown out basically in the Lakers series, but I think Denver's proven to have more depth than we thought, you know, going into the playoffs. I love Bruce Brown. I think I kind of view it as like a starting, I read something today. They refer to it as a starting six for that team. So I think they're strong there. Miami kind of has, to your point, like more random guys that can plug in here and there. Like Kevin Love was starting for the first five games of that and then didn't play at all in 6 and 7. I think we see him plug back in. Highsmith came in and was effective in a couple games there. You add Hero back into the mix, more of those guys. But I don't know about you, Britt. I don't feel like I see a huge bench advantage one way or the other in this series. Do you?
Well, I mean, I think bench is the hardest thing to predict in any series. Playoffs are hyper matchup oriented and how somebody slots in. I mean, Mazzulla for the Celtics was throwing Pritchard and Hauser and guys in like at times where you go, whoa, wait a minute. And
all the white dudes.
Most of the guys on the bench are the white dudes. No coincidence, right? Yeah. But I think that the bench is the place where you say this might work on a micro level for 4 minutes. And you don't think that way in February. You don't think that way in November. You're thinking one of these, you know, I'm trying to get 1/4 of the series won tonight, you know? And so you play your hunch, you play your analytics, and it's the place where you decide what you think you can do. His point about Miami having more players you could play hunches with than Denver, I think is accurate. But I think that I would argue that Miami's culture is a 10-man culture, and Denver's culture is Jokic.
Survive non-Jokic minutes.
The people who play best around Jokic and then the people who play best without Jokic is how rotations get determined. I'm a huge Christian Brown fan, and I was saddened to see that the playoffs were a little bit bigger than his moment. He's a very aggressive defender, and the refs were not kind to him in the last two series, Phoenix or Los Angeles, and Malone realized that. I think he got benched because he was getting the team into early team foul trouble, and also they were attacking him, and it was beginning to get on people's minds within the team. The two Browns with different spelling names are really good. And Jeff Green, who I've never been a fan of, he's been kind of a replacement player for a decade now. Playing very well.
That's all they need.
They call him Uncle Jeff Green in Denver, and I understand it. I think that if Tyler Hero comes back, Miami will go 9.
Yeah.
I think that Denver will continue to go 7. They may go Christian Brown if people get in foul trouble. Mm-hmm. But I think that given the gap, the thing about the finals is there's a lot of distance between the games.
Yeah.
And so I think that Malone will be comfortable going 6. Mm-hmm. The quick answer is if Miami's depth makes a difference, that's a huge negative for Denver. I don't anticipate it being so.
And Hero could be the factor there that slides that needle, I think, a little bit. Do you have another question?
Well, one question is, like, if Tyler Hero comes back game 3, do you even play him?
Honestly, I don't know how to – probably because they're so – I mean, I think that's where they really stalled out in the – particularly once Gabe Vincent rolled his ankle, they needed another offensive creator. And I think Hero brings that, if nothing else, to this team that, I mean, Miami is so much more defense than they are offense. And they kind of need, it's one of those situations where we talk about the Jordan Pools, the D'Angelo Russells, these guys who quote unquote can't be played in the playoffs. Well, if you have a defensive infrastructure, I think you can play those type of players and they actually serve a lot of value in those situations. So I would view Hero to be a plus in this. I was surprised you didn't have a Wolves question.
Well, and the only other thing I'll say is it disruptive, like as far as having a smaller roster, obviously somebody gets hurt for Denver, let's say. And if, you know, the Heat plays somebody for a quarter that just doesn't work out, say the 10th man, like, what, I guess what's worse? And we can move on.
I think to Britt's point, though, there is multiple days off between all these games. I think we see, as we do in the finals, things just kind of shrinking down in general. Like, I don't think you need 9, would be my way to say it, for either team in this series, unless a matchup or something provides it. Do we have another question? You got another question here?
I do have actually a more Wolves pertinent question. So assuming especially that Denver does kind of roll like we're kind of expecting, is there any change in perception of like the Wolves' success based on like how much they've just cruised through the West? And does it change your outlook on like our positioning in the conference?
Take that, Britt.
I don't think it does. I'm tired of the rationalization of that the Gobert-Towns thing worked out just fine after all. It didn't. I lose patience with it because it did not take long for Kat to start talking about the fact, well, I wasn't notified of this trade and you know, I don't know if I, you know, playing 4 or 5, all of a sudden I'm playing the 4. Every player now reads social media and every player now is starting to think about how they want to position themselves for whatever shitstorm they perceive is coming their way. And the Gobert Towns look in terms of the way both of them have regarded themselves at the end of the season and the way they've regarded their team at the end of the season is not one that breeds natural confidence. Like, we'll be fine. We just needed a few games. We never got it. We didn't have that chance. They said those words in a roundabout way. They did not believe those words to me pretty obviously. Denver, beat the Wolves pretty handily in that series. They destroyed them in the first game, and they understood they were going to win the series after that. So it was a 1-8, and Phoenix had a lot more pub and cred and whatever you wanted to call it, and the Lakers even more so than that. And so they were more locked in. They understood they were further along. So no, the answer to me is no.
Yeah, I think to me the answer is Denver's better than I thought they were entering the playoffs. So any sort of catering I would do to the Wolves, what happened in that series is maybe falling down 3-0 is a little less shocking, but it was always a long, long, long shot in my mind that they could have won that series. And I'm not personally big on if it took 5 games, 6 games, or 7 games. I know we just did this of like pick a series and how many games. That's never how I viewed series. It's just kind of like, can you win it or not? Did you feel that at some point that you had a shot in that series? And while game 4 was really good for the Wolves, I never found myself at any point in that series feeling like they had a shot against this team, which I guess to their credit, like same with the Lakers, didn't feel that way. I did go into the Phoenix series thinking that would be close. I picked Phoenix to win that. But I guess that's more, in my mind, an indictment of what my thought process was on Denver than what the actual value was of the Wolves, Suns, or Lakers in any sort of way. I think it's your, I know Wolves fans probably don't want to hear this, but I just think it's your way of spinning something that makes it seem better than it was. And the reality of the situation is anybody in the Western Conference would have got smoked by the Nuggets, you know, including the Wolves.
What a nation of unbiased basketball watchers saw was a gentleman's sweep in the first round.
Yes, yes. All right, let's take another question.
I will try to keep us on the train of Wolves questions for those of us thirsting for Wolves.
No apologies. We actually find that the Wolves people are more interested in talking about the Wolves than they are about the other things, quite frankly. So we're game for anything.
Right. But one of the things that I find really compelling about watching playoff basketball, and I love playoff basketball because I find it's competent, incredibly competent, but not perfect teams, is that a lot of those teams, you see things that they do really well and you see their flaws. And so a couple of examples that come to mind that I think of is one of the biggest Wolves flaws in the past years has been rebounding. And I watch the Knicks offensive rebound over the Cavs. And that was a huge reason Mitchell Robinson, why they win that series. I watch the Heat beat the Celtics. I watch Kyle Lowry defensive rebounding against Robert Williams. They rebounded incredibly well in that series. So as you guys have been watching the playoffs, I guess I'm curious on what your thoughts are. What are some of the things that, as we look forward, the Wolves roster as it's currently constructed, you can look at and be like, yep, they do that well in the context of what teams do well in the playoffs and what they drastically need to improve on?
One come to mind for you?
Well, I mean, what they do well is score in the paint. It was the game plan, and they do it well. They're a very strong they attack offensively. They attack in the paint deliberately and effectively. I think that also they fly around well when they want to fly around on defense. They are a very good defensive fly-around team. I have a harder time answering that question if you ask me what the Wolves do comprehensively well. I mean, what the Wolves can bank on.
It's probably just Ant.
Well, I mean, again, but think of all the games where Ant didn't disappear but wasn't Tatum-esque, wasn't Paul George-esque, wasn't giving you 26, 9, and 7 as he was throughout January. Why wasn't Ant doing in February and March and early April what he was doing in January? Now, some of that is a good thing. Mike Conley joined the team, but some of it was not a good thing. They kept on trying to ram square pegs into round holes, and Ant wasn't in any shape to play that game.
I mean, I take that, and maybe this is positively, to be a product of age. I think it's increasingly unlikely the younger you are to be consistent. Like, we talk about this all the time. Like, a big game, you know, it can even be in November and the Wolves are playing the Lakers or the Warriors or whatever. I'm thinking about going into that game, more likely than not, I'm thinking about it being a good Ant game.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is broadly proven to be true in terms, whether it's in terms of his effectiveness or not, but in terms of his aggression and mindset, mentality as he approaches that matchup. And now what we've seen, to his credit, for 2 years in the playoffs, is he's done that in those higher leverage type situations where he is, honestly, in many ways, like Jokic, unguardable in a one-on-one type situation. Denver had nothing for him in terms of guarding him one-on-one. You need to start to plan your entire defense around Anthony Edwards. And I think if you're optimistically looking at a playoff run for the Wolves next season, you go, it is unlikely that an opponent will have something to be able to slow down Ant without opening up great opportunities for the surrounding pieces. Rudy, Kat, Jaden, whoever else, there within the mix. And so I guess like that he cracks the egg open, right, in other words. But yeah, in terms of a specific, they do great rebounding or 3-point shooting or defensively that. Like, no, we don't have one. I like that you brought up the like kind of bludgeoning at the rim. That is probably the thing that as of today, right now, that you can say that feels like a bankable thing that the Wolves could do kind of in any sort of playoff series. The question is, how does that, you have that because you're such a big team, right? And where is that subtracted against on the other side of the floor or in transition? Yes, Kat and Rudy and Ant can get to the rim at will. But when those three were on the floor during the regular season, the other team did that against them.
Well, and the reason why it was a good question was because my first answer, and one that you just seconded, was talking about a bottom 10 offense.
Yeah.
So it was the best thing about a bottom 10 offense. And when I would like to flip over to defense, where they were, I think seventh, was it? They finished. Anyway, they were a top 10 defense, yeah, if I'm not mistaken. It is less clear because what you can do with Rudy and what you can do without Rudy and what you do with everybody else, what you can do with some really interesting, compelling wing defenders where you have depth there now between Nah and McDaniels and Minot, I would throw in that mix. And
you would.
You have the capability to fly around again in a really good fashion.
That could be, like, if the Wolves had a great playoff run next year, it's like, the combination of Ant, the combination of getting to the rim, and the combination of controlled chaos defensively would be their recipe for making a playoff run next year with this roster.
And followers of this podcast know I'm going to again say something that I've said increasingly since the end of the season. If they prioritize Ant, and if they prioritize what Ant can do best, and they regard Kat and Gobert as side pieces that have the type of extraordinary but narrow skills that make them fantastic side pieces used in the right way, then I'm fairly optimistic about this team. I don't feel like organizationally they have yet prioritized Ant over the Cat Gobert synergy that they think exists.
That's pretty for this season at least, that was pretty undeniable. Have another question here?
Yeah, 15 minutes before game one, I won't ask a basketball business related question. So instead, I'll ask in honor of Britt's birthday about his favorite first round rookie. Is there any internal buzz about Wendell Moore? Like, it seems weird in hindsight that the freshman drafted in the mid to late 40s is getting more hype than Wendell Moore, someone who has the pedigree of being a McDonald's All-American, 3 years at Duke that played a prominent role on teams that were winning teams. So any buzz, or is it just a sunk cost, so to speak?
I wouldn't say it's a sunk cost, so to speak. I think what happened – thank you for the question – what I think happened was Finch lost trust in Wendell. I know from just having on the side talked to him about that. Like, what he said to me is he thinks Wendell's going to be a really good player, but the actions out there showed that he was not someone they could trust. And I think those of us who were watching closely kind of saw that Wendell looked anxious out there when he played. It's a little disappointing for a player who had played 3 years in college. Like, he was, in an ideal world, right, pitched to be the type of guy that you take at the end of the first round and probably is in your rotation the first year. I think that was that anxiety or lack of confidence that Wendell had really held him back. I also think, and I mean, we talked about this dating back to Summer League, I remember watching him in person for the first time for me in Vegas. Was I left that going, what is the one skill? What is your one NBA skill that is clear? And I think that you can be an incredible basketball, high school player, college player, all those sort of things. But when you're like 6'4", like Wendell is, what is your thing that you are going to be able to do at the NBA level? And I had nothing to point to. out of Summer League, which isn't the greatest example of that. I think that kind of played out. We saw that one game, right, when they played against Ja Morant and he guarded Ja really well. Like, I think that's kind of like, I don't want to say that's his ceiling, but I think that was like the ceiling of what you could expect from him as a rookie, is just do really basic stuff at a competent level. I don't know what the next level thing he could do would be. I think, though, go full circle, whatever that is, it's only unlocked with confidence from him that he didn't have as a rookie. You got anything on that?
What's the opposite of preaching to the choir? Preaching to the devils? I mean, I'm not a Wendell Moore guy. I like the pick because I don't follow college basketball, and I like the idea of a three-year starter at Duke who used to do a lot of different things and fill a lot of different gaps. And after the first Summer League game, I thought, all right, this guy's going to be good. And then the second Summer League game, he wasn't good.
And the fourth.
And then I got to say, he has an extremely low ceiling. Shabazz Muhammad was also a McDonald's All-American. I mean, there's a lot of McDonald's All-Americans who are playing in Europe right now. Wendell Moore can do what you ask him if you ask him to do a specific thing as a ninth man. If you ask him to guard Ja Morant, I think he can do that fairly well. If you ask him to be a hockey assist guy, I think he can do that. If you ask him to do a specific bench role, I think he can do that. But so can, almost everybody else on the team. I don't think it was a bad pick per se. It was a great draft.
You're right.
Walker Kessler and Josh Minot indicate to me that Tim Connelly had a really good draft. I would say Wendell Moore was the mistake in that three. I'd be happy to be proven wrong because it would give the Wolves another usable piece. But I just didn't see it. I think he's a really nice guy. I think he's a smart basketball player. I think he gets the most out of his ability, which is damning him with faint praise.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
We could take maybe a couple more questions here, and we'll go until the game starts. But, fire away.
I just had a question. You guys have talked about at length the new CBA. Obviously, that's going into effect at the end of next season. And I was just curious, like, there's a time clock on this core of Ant, Jaden, Rudy, and Carl. What, like, if they don't decide to make a move this summer, what is the pros and cons of waiting to the deadline or even next offseason to make a move on one of those guys, probably Kat or Rudy, compared to trying to trade them this summer for something? I know the last one you guys also talked about, the Scoot Henderson one, mm-hmm. or potentially Scoot Henderson, the Portland Trailblazers one. Just what is, like, the pros and cons of trying to wait and see compared to trying to trade one of them this summer? So,
I just think wait and see comes with an obvious con of a wall coming, right? Like, I mean, Carl, his contract's going to kick in for 35% of the cap. Rudy's contract is 31% of the cap. Ant is going to get a max for 25% or 30 if he makes all NBA. I mean, that's 91 or 96% of the entire salary cap to those three players. I was looking it up, and Jaden, like we've talked about this before too, we kind of like project the Mikal Bridges type contract, right? Which has become a great contract. So I don't think that's, I actually think that's a conservative estimate. And Bridges signed for 17% of the cap. So if you just in those four players, when we take the 17% number, that's 108% of the cap to those four. And if Ant makes all NBA, 113%. And yes, you can go over the salary cap, but the luxury tax starts at 121%, which the Wolves have very rarely gone into. I mean, maybe only the Cassell and Sprewell.
They had to double the Sprees.
I think they will go into the tax. I don't think you view the luxury tax as a line necessarily, but that line, like you're already into the tax just with those four players. And if you did 11 minimum contracts, that's no Mike Conley. That's letting Conley walk in a year. That's letting Kyle Anderson walk in a year. That's obviously letting Naz Reid walk now. Nickeil Alexander walk now. Like, yes, you can get that second apron if we're going really nerdy with the numbers. Like, that's 134% of the cap. Like, it's not possible. It's not possible to bring back more players than those four and minimum contracts, really. I mean, yes, maybe you could do one of them. I mean, you have a little bit of percentage of the cap to work with there, but we talked about that on the last pod a lot, and a lot of people are like, well, yes, you could if you just did Cat, Rudy, Ant, Jaden, and then you like brought back Naz and Nickeil if they were for cheap numbers. Like, yes, you're right there. But that would be nine players on minimum contracts, which is Bryn Forbes, Austin Rivers, Nate Knight, all guys who can do, I mean, they're NBA players. But as we were just talking about in terms of the playoffs, like, you need 7, 8, 9 guys for the playoffs. You need 10, 11, 12, 13. Well, we got to Luka Garza played like 600 minutes this year. He's like 17. You know, like, I don't know. I don't know what to tell people other than those are the numbers. And we can't know what Mark Lowry and Alex Rodriguez's appetite is for paying the tax. I think we can know they're not going to go into the second, beyond the second apron, because that comes with a whole bunch of prohibitive measures that aren't even related to money. Like, show me how these numbers work that make it so you can have those four players that everyone wants, plus rounding out that team with other competent pieces. I don't know. So yes, can you run it? That's 2024, 2025. Not this coming season, the season after that. But that's coming. Those are facts. Like, Cat is already signed for 35% of the cap. Rudy's already signed for 31. If you think Ant's not getting the max, like, what are you? He's getting the max. Like, I don't see how Jaden isn't at least at that number. So I don't know. I would love the team to have those four players and Naz Reid and Nickeil Alexander Walker and bring back Kyle Anderson and maybe get Mike Conley on a cheapy contract. But you cannot do that. You cannot bring back all of those players, including the core four, without exceeding the second apron, which the Golden State Warriors aren't going to do. The Clippers aren't going to do. I don't know why we think the Minnesota Timberwolves would do it. So yes, like, change is coming. That I can't see a path to tell you, and I've looked, that it could be anything different than that. So I don't know. I think they run it back for a year, but that 12 months from now, we're going to be talking about this of someone has to go. And I don't know what they're going to do about that. I really don't. You have anything on that?
Well, you're the best in town and one of the best in the NBA at doing this stuff. I don't have any standing to disagree with anyone.
What do you think about the idea? If I'm right, well, that you cannot have those four players and build out a competent roster.
I do have a general opinion as a layman in the terms you're talking about. And what I would say as a layman is that if you make the Rudy Gobert trade and then you become a chicken shit about the salary cap, you've compounded your stupidity.
But that is the interesting part about this is it's not just money. It's not just money and luxury tax anymore. It is losing the mid-level except it's losing all the nerdy things that are actually really important.
I don't think they should go to the second apron, but I also think that if you don't put pressure on this team, if you don't say you made this deal with a certain set of expectations in mind, and if you're going to compromise those expectations, then you have operated in bad faith in owning this basketball team. And so what I would say is you have to keep the core four or trade one of them. One of them would be Cat this year because 35 becomes 50. Yes, the logic of what you're saying is trade Cat.
The logic of
the Gobert trade was you need to make at least a two-year commitment to this enormous investment. So if you're not going to trade Cat, then you have to say we're going to eat a lot of money that may not be good money, but that's because we made a bad decision. And I think that the fan bases would be right to pressure that. Unless you want to get off both and do a kind of a quasi rebuild around your young core, you either trade Cat this year or Gobert before next year to get out of that situation. I don't see trading Ant or McDaniels. I see them getting market value that's going to talk about the numbers you're talking about. So all I'm saying is it's going to be painful financially. That's what owners are for. If owners want to swing big dicks, then they have to understand what happens when they get exposed.
And I think that's part of the issue is it was not understood what this was going to be when they made the Gobert trade. We did not know that this was the collective bargaining agreement and that this is what it was going to look like then. They probably should have had a little bit more foresight in knowing that something along these lines were coming. But I think even in their estimations of what that was, this has proven to be more punitive in terms of spending in the league. And as has become a hot button topic, not just related to the Wolves, but all the other teams who have invested in two or three max players, the Wolves, I would predict, are not going to be the only team that is forced to pivot off of their triple max contract look. And they are going to have a triple max contract look because they already have two signed to it. And Ant is obviously going to get that. It's not a Wolvesy thing. It's the Clippers will face the word, whatever. Like everybody's going to face that sort of thing. And that is
but coming. Which of these teams is unlike the other? The Wolves are not only babes in the woods, but they're babes in a lot more dangerous woods than they were in when they first walked in.
Exactly.
So the point being, if you make big swings at things, if you go for broke, then you are in a mindset that you have to sustain or immediately, commit Harry Carey over, you know? I mean,
there's just a difference in going broke in terms of the assets you have on your team and the owners actually asking the owners to go broke in terms of their own finances is what this is going, right? Those are two different things. And
the value of NBA franchises
is not standing up for
them. They're not going down.
Yeah.
I mean, if Lowry and A-Rod go broke, you know, as you know, Ronan Royce says, oh, shucks, you know.
Thank you. That's a good question. We can do another question here. And then I think we got the national anthem going on here. So we'll wrap it up here shortly.
That's another 5 minutes.
Yeah, I'll try to be quick. But what do you guys think between the dichotomy of like the Wolves versus the Heat? Because one 8 seed is defeated by Denver in 5, and one 8 seed is about to play Denver in the NBA Finals. Where do you feel the difference between the two teams are? Because I don't think we lose on talent. Spoelstra is a pretty good coach, and I don't think Finch is a bad coach, but I don't know where to draw the line of, like, this is the difference. This is where we fall down versus the Heat.
I could answer it more fully, but I'd say just culture is such a part of that. One, that both of these two teams that are about to play right now in the NBA Finals have been deeply focused on cultivating over the course of the past decade. And the Wolves have had so little continuity that they didn't even get to the U when they started spelling culture. You know, like it's they don't, they're not there. And a lot of teams are that way too. But yeah, in terms of like talent, if we just lined it up and we're playing 2K or whatever, like the Wolves don't look like they have that much less talent than either of these teams. But there's a reason the Wolves were the 8th seed and bounced in the first round, and these teams are still here. Like, to me, and I didn't even know exact, I don't know how to cultivate that, but I know they need to make that happen.
Well, I mean, what got lost in the Gobert trade, and we talked about this on the last podcast, actually, they have made some really significant cultural moves. I mean, whatever you think of Mike Conley and whatever you think of D'Angelo Russell.
That was a culture move, yeah.
When it comes to culture, D'Angelo Russell is not a culture guy. Let's face it. I mean, you just look at the culture of the teams he's been on. And then you look at the culture of the teams Mike Conley has been on. Has the culture improved or has it eroded? That trade for a fairly negative culture guy going away and a fairly positive culture guy coming are exactly the kinds of moves you make that are not the Gobert splash, are not the Towns signing splash, but are the things that you invest. And that, to be honest with you, is where Tim Connelly made his bones. That's what made it so stupid.
He built this team we're about to watch, yeah.
All of a sudden, you know, he had, I mean, Calvin Booth did a great job this year, by the way, had a great draft and great free agent signings. KCP and Bruce Brown are both vital players. But Tim Connelly has his fingerprints all over a team that's poised to win the NBA champions. And he came in and changed his spots with a Gobert trade. Some would argue that's Wolves culture leaning into him. But yeah, I think it's safe to say without wasting too many more words that the difference between the Heat and the Wolves is night and day, and it begins with the words culture.
And I think to wrap it up, I think you can build a culture around Anthony Edwards if you focus on doing that, which is kind of this whole next chapter of Wolves basketball. Thank you guys all for coming out here. We appreciate it. We'll watch this game with you. We also, Falling Knife has a birthday cake, I believe, for Britt Robson, so come and grab some cake. We appreciate you guys all coming out and listening all year. Seriously, thank you. It means a bunch to me. We'll talk to y'all soon. And those of you listening at home, I'll talk to you next week. Until then, he's Britt. I'm Dane. We're at Falling Knife Brewing.
Thanks for coming out.
Peace out. How I'm feeling, I hope it never stop, yeah. Bring it out so you can find me in the crowd, yeah, yeah. Don't let standards ever bring you down, yeah. Hope you dancing like nobody else.